James 1:5 through 1:8. The fourth talk in a series on James was presented by Ron Julian on January 15, 2006 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved.
Good morning. We are continuing in James. Last week we talked about wisdom and how James encourages us to pray for wisdom if we lack it. I have been arguing that the book of James, he is addressing the testing of our faith, those situations that God takes us through where we are forced to confront the question, is this for me? Do I really believe this gospel? Is this what I want my life to be about? Am I actually going to pursue this, or is something else more interesting to me? And in the process, I think, James has given a word of encouragement to those who would hear his word and recognize that this process of the testing of faith and the maturing and wisdom that grows through that process, that it really doesn't characterize their life. And what would I do if that were the case? And what he encourages us to do is to pray to God for wisdom, the God who will not reproach us, the God who is generous. We're not done with this idea of praying to God for wisdom yet. We sort of started in the middle of it, because he stops the encouraging word that he gives to kind of give a sober and somewhat striking word of warning. So that's what we want to talk about today, is that sober word of warning that he gives. Let me start reading in verse 6. But if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all generously and without reproach, and it will be given to him. But let him ask in faith without any doubting, for the one who doubts is like the surf of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. For let not that man expect that he will receive anything from the Lord, being a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. So our topic this morning is a big one. It's actually a very big one, and there's probably much more to say than I'll be able to say about it. But the issue is faith and doubt, because that's what James is talking about. In this case, before we actually look at the passage to see what James is getting at here specifically, I think we need to back up and think a little bit about this idea of faith and doubt. Because you and I don't come to a passage like this as blank slates. The fact is that we have heard, I'm sure most of you have heard ideas about what it means to be a person of faith. What is faith? What is doubt? What does it look like to doubt? What am I supposed to do instead? And I think some of the ideas that we have been exposed to are not really biblical ideas, and I don't think they're really in the running for what James means. So before we actually look at the passage, I'd like to just consider a couple of options for what he might mean by faith and doubt here. And I'd like to argue that they're not, in fact, what he means, and in fact, they're not biblical ideas at all. One popular idea for what it means to pray in faith sounds like it is taught by Jesus himself. And I just have to admit this right up front. The passage that I'm about to refer to sounds very, very much like Jesus is saying exactly what I'm going to say is not biblical. So that's going to be a trick. I'm going to explain to you why Jesus is not saying what he sounds like he's saying. But that's what I'm going to do, so just be ready. Jesus has enacted a parable here. He has come across a fig tree, and he curses the fig tree, and it withers. And the disciples are amazed. They pointed out, look at that. Look what happened. And so in response, I'm going to read the section in Mark 11:23. Jesus says, truly I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, be taken up and cast into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says is going to happen, it shall be granted him. Therefore I say to you, all things for which you pray and ask, believe that you have received them, and they shall be granted you. Okay, so what it sounds like Jesus is saying here is that if you believe hard enough that you're going to get something from God, you will get it. If you have perfect faith, with no doubt in your mind at all that you will get what you're asking for, then you will get it. The key is, empty your mind of any possibility that you won't get it. And if you, in fact, are convinced that you will get it, then you will, whatever it is you ask for. This is one popular picture of what it means to pray in faith. And oftentimes, Christians who come from this perspective, you know, there's something that they say, okay, what I want is, I want somebody to come walking through the door and give me $1 billion. Unfortunately, I look, and it's David who's walking through the door, so it's not likely to happen, probably. Ye of little faith is the thing here. Now, that's the problem, you see, that attitude of mine. I'm thinking about what I know about David in the past and all of that stuff, and I'm thinking, well, it's probably not likely that he's going to come walking up here and give me $1 billion. But that's the problem, you see. That's where I need to have faith. If I could only convince myself that, in fact, that's what's going to happen, then it would. If I were to pray to God, have someone come walking in that door and give me $1 billion and believe that it was going to happen, then it would happen. Now, notice how tricky that sort of situation is, because in those kinds of scenarios, what we're being asked to pray for is kind of implausible to start with. That is, I don't have any real reason to think that God intends to give me $1 billion or anything like that. But that's the very thing that my faith must overcome in this scenario. I don't have any reason to think that God's going to do this, but if I can convince myself that God's going to do this, then it will happen. And if it doesn't happen, there's always the great fallback, you didn't have enough faith. If you had only truly believed that it was going to happen, then it would have. Now, as much as it might sound like that's what Jesus is saying here, I would like to argue that that is not what he's saying here. And I have several things that enter into my thinking here. First of all, let's just admit this problem right away. I mean, we're going to have to deal with this however you answer this question. Nobody experiences life this way. Nobody has a relationship with God where anything they want, they just believe it up hard enough and God gives it to them. Everyone has the experience. Every Christian that has ever lived and recorded their scenario in such a way, well, I can't even think of an example altogether, but everyone would tell you that in their interaction with God, that in their prayers, sometimes God says no and sometimes God says yes. So that's something that we have to deal with. We have to ask ourselves, what does that mean? You know, Jesus gives the example here of telling the mountain to go jump in the sea. So we even have his example given to us, and yet I'm not aware of any Christian at any time has ever told a mountain to go jump in the sea, and it did. I mean, and yet Jesus is saying, if you believe it happens, it will. So we might argue to this, well, we shouldn't let our experience dictate what God is saying in the Bible. That's possible, in which case what we have here is Jesus making a promise that is almost completely hypothetical. You could, if you could somehow eliminate all doubt, have anything you want, because you would get it if you fervently believed that you were going to get it, but evidently such faith is rare to non-existent, so it probably won't happen. I mean, that is a possibility, that we could just say Jesus is saying something that is technically true but practically irrelevant, because nobody ever has that kind of certainty when they're dealing with God. Maybe it's our fault. Maybe we should have that kind of certainty. But as it happens, nobody does, and so this really doesn't amount to much. But I don't think that's going to work, which brings me to another problem with this perspective, which would indicate to me that that approach isn't going to work. In other passages where Jesus uses this same picture of telling the mountain to jump into the sea, he says that it will happen if we have faith the size of a mustard seed. In other words, what he's trying to get across is it doesn't take a huge, superhuman, perfect act of perfect faith to make this mountain jump into the sea. Just the teeniest little bit of faith will get that mountain to jump in the sea. So the picture that he paints is not one of, if you can arrive at this superhuman act of faith, you can make great things happen, but just an ordinary little bit of faith is enough to make big things happen. So that doesn't seem to fit that picture, this idea that somehow he's painted the idea that there is this huge, perfect act of faith that theoretically could make big things happen. That's not going to work. He seems to be suggesting that anybody could do this, that the littlest amount of genuine faith would be enough to result in the mountain jumping into the sea. So this scenario is looking a little shaky. The biggest problem I have with this scenario, though, is this. The implication of this is that if I totally believe that God will give me something, he will. In other words, if my faith is big enough, God will never say no. If we take Jesus' words as meaning what it sounds like he might mean, then he is in essence saying that you never ever need to hear no from God, because if you believe it enough, you'll get it. But that's not the picture that we get from the Bible at all. Is there anyone who's ever had more faith than Jesus? And yet he prayed to the Father that he would not have to go to the cross, and the Father said, no, you have to go. Paul asked God to remove what he called his thorn in the flesh, and God said, no. The picture that we get of God in the Bible is not a vending machine that if you put in the proper amount of faith, you automatically get back the thing you're asking for. The picture we have from God is of a person, a loving father, who gives his children what they need. Sometimes we say yes to our children, and sometimes we say no to our children. We do that because we understand what they need better than they do. The picture that we have of God is not someone who is automatically guaranteed to give us what we want if we believe it hard enough. It is rather a God who loves us and says yes out of love and says no out of love. He hasn't put it in our hands to determine what we're going to get. He has left it in his hands to determine what we're going to get. But he is interacting with us lovingly as we seek from him what we think we need. So I think that Jesus cannot be understood to be saying that if we believe it hard enough, there is no doubt that we will get it. I don't think that's what he's getting at. Instead, I think he means something like this. This is how I would read the scenario. The disciples have seen a miracle. Jesus called on God to curse the tree, and it withered right there on the same day. Their response is essentially, wow, that kind of stuff doesn't happen. I mean, that's not literally what they said, but I think that's the idea is, whoa, look at that. I mean, like, that's wild. That kind of stuff doesn't happen. And Jesus is speaking, I think, to that sense of that kind of stuff doesn't happen. And what he's saying is something like this. Well, let's think about that, whether stuff like this happens. I am the Messiah praying to the Father to do an attesting miracle, a miracle that attests to my authority and also is a message. It has a parable inherent in this act that I am asking God to do. Why are you surprised that such a thing would happen? God is able to do anything at all. He made this world, he sustains this world, and he can change anything in it anytime he wants. And I know he is willing to do this because I am calling on him to do the very sort of thing I know that he wants me to do. Testify to my judgment on what is happening in this world, and also for him to testify that I, in fact, have the authority that I do. an attesting miracle that sends a message to my people. That's exactly the sort of thing that God wants to do. God is willing to do it and able to do it. The only thing left then is to be a person who believes him. The problem that the disciples faced is the same problem that you and I face. We live in a world where it is easy to lose sight of God. As we go on from day to day, God does not make himself known in obvious ways. But the powers of this world make themselves known in obvious ways. I know that if I can get in with somebody on the city council, I have a better chance of getting my permit approved for the building that I want to do, or something like that. I know how this world works. I know that if certain influential people decide that they don't like me, I'm going to be in trouble. I know that if I make less money, life is going to be harder because the things that I need to do will be harder to do. I mean, I've learned all sorts of lessons in this world from tangible things that have taught me those lessons through experience every day. When I'm dealing with God, I'm dealing with one who, in theory, has the power to override all the powers of this world. But the question is, has it come home to me? Have I come to see it? Have I come to understand that that, in fact, is who I'm dealing with? It's easy to think that the powers that I deal with every day are the powers that matter. But ultimately, that is the attitude of unbelief. God is big enough to do everything he wants. True, we have to also address the issue of whether he wants to do something. But when we know that God is willing, then it is truly appropriate for us to believe that it will happen, because God is really there and he is really able to do it. So I think Jesus is saying, don't be surprised by this miracle. God is able to do anything he sets his hand to. And anything he has promised to do, he will do, if the one asking him is a believer, a person who does not doubt that God exists and that he is willing and able to do what he promised. So Jesus is calling them to not have an attitude of, it's a kind of skepticism. Wow, that's so wild that just happened, I can hardly believe that it happened. What he's saying is, look, we are dealing with the God of the universe. He is quite capable of doing what we call on him to do. So when he talks about the mountain being cast into the sea, I don't think he's meaning to imply, if you happen to come across a mountain and you happen to decide that you would like that mountain to cast itself into the sea, if you believe hard enough, it will. But I think what he is saying, in fact, is that when we are praying to God to cast a mountain into the sea, and with the implicit idea that we have reason to think that God would be willing to do such a thing, to cast a mountain into the sea, that we should do it with confidence. That even though it's a mountain attached to the ground in a pretty big way in front of me there, that God, it is not beyond God to throw that mountain into the sea. The strength of my faith is irrelevant. I don't have to be a strong person to cast a mountain into the sea. All I have to do is to be a person who believes that God is capable of casting a mountain into the sea. And so the issue is definitely one of doubt. But the issue is not one of anything that I decide I want to have happen, I can make it happen by believing it. Rather, what Jesus is saying is, God is capable of doing incredibly big things for incredibly small people, and all it takes is to be a person who believes that he will. Now, quickly, I'd like to address another popular idea about faith, and I almost could let this one go, except I hear it so often these days. And this idea is the idea that somehow faith means believing in spite of the evidence. So to not doubt would mean to ignore the evidence that would suggest it's not true and believe it anyway. Normally, we look at evidence and ask, what is reasonable to believe? But faith, according to this view, ignores evidence and just believes anyway. A strong faith is a faith that can ignore all the evidence. You have a weak faith because when you look at the evidence and it suggests it's not true, you say, oh, well, it might not be true. that person has a strong faith because they look at the evidence that suggests it's not true and say, I don't care, it's true anyway. So a lack of doubt, in essence, translates into a total indifference to what reason and evidence would tell me is true. I'm sorry. You know, when you... Definition, that's what I was looking for. Definition of faith. Oh, dear. Anybody want to take over at this point? Okay, so, because, I mean, probably most of us have not... Well, I don't know. I think most of us probably have not been raised in an environment where that's the way we think about faith. But the fact is that it's a very popular idea in our culture that faith is what about is about that. What I've noticed is that the debate over intelligent design has raised this issue constantly. I mean, just about every day you can find an editorial somewhere with somebody saying that the reason that we shouldn't be messing around with ideas like intelligent design is that science is all about evidence and faith is all about just believing without evidence. And so there's no putting these two things together. And of course, the implicit idea is, since believing on the basis of evidence is reasonable and believing with no evidence is not reasonable, then science wins because faith is stupid. But they don't say that because they're trying to be nice. I mean, sure, let's leave room for those people of faith out there, those nice people who believe things that obviously aren't true. Well, that's what we hear a lot that faith is about, but I just want to remind us that's not a biblical picture of what faith is at all. The Bible's picture is that unbelief is in fact irrational. Unbelief is a putting aside of the evidence. Especially in Romans, Paul argues that mankind pushes aside the knowledge of God because we don't want it to be true. We don't want to admit that God is there, that we owe him anything, that he has any right to judge our lives, and so on. John says that he wrote the Gospel of John in order to give us evidence and reasons to believe that Jesus is the Christ. Now, we can debate with the non-believer whether the reasons are sufficient or not. I hope that we here are convinced that the reasons are sufficient. But the fact is, the Bible is arguing that belief is reasonable. It is rational because it's the way things are. And if you look carefully and think well about the world that you live in, it will become apparent that the Bible's message is true. So faith is not the absence of reason and evidence. Faith is submitting to where reason and evidence ought to take you, when we understand that reason and evidence in the deepest sense. Okay, so a couple of things here that I've tried to eliminate as possibilities. When James is going to encourage us to have faith and not to doubt, I would like to argue that, number one, he is not saying that I have faith in anything that I might happen to want to believe is true, that if I don't doubt it, I'll get it. And secondly, he is not talking about an irrational not doubting because I'm not willing to consider the evidence, I'm just going to believe it anyway. Neither of those things is what he has in mind. Let me talk about a couple of the words in the passage here, and then let's try to sum up what I think he's getting at. First of all, there's this word doubt. We're not to doubt. The idea of this word is wavering between two options, not committing on one side or the other. In fact, this word has several meanings. Sometimes it's used to talk about judging or discerning. And the idea is I have these two parties that I am judging, I am sorting out. I'm listening to this person's story, I'm listening to this person's story. And so in the process of judging, I am impartially stepping back and considering both sides as possible. Well, to doubt is in essence to continue to that process of I'm evaluating the situation when I really ought to have at this point come in on one side or the other. It is to waver between the options when in fact there's good reason for me to have settled on one or the other. And so to doubt when it comes to God is to waver it might be true that there is a God and that I ought to look to him for life, but then again, it might not be true. Paul says that Abraham believed the promise that Isaac would be born, even though Abraham was old and Sarah was barren. And so he says, Abraham did not waver in unbelief, is the way the New American Standard translates it. Well, that's this word waver there, that's our word here for doubt. That idea of I'm back and forth, well, it might be true, might not be true, I don't know. James gives a vivid analogy, and we will notice throughout the book, by the way, that James loves vivid analogies. It's one of the things I like about James is he loves to throw in a concrete picture that illustrates the idea that he's talking about. And here, he says, the one who doubts is like the waves driven and tossed by the wind. If the wind blows one way, the waves go that way. If the wind blows another way, the waves go that way. There's no substance. A wave is not like a building that the wind blows on and yet it stands. The wind is trying to make it go that way, but it stands and holds its ground. The wind blows, and that's where the wave goes. And so we can be that same way in the way we come to God. If I've just heard a good sermon or seen something beautiful in nature, I think, sure, there's a God. But if hard times come along or the distracting riches of the world come along, I think, I can't really count on some abstract God at a time like this. I need to rely on something real, money or political power or whatever it might be, something that I know comes through for you. So that's the kind of wavering that he's talking about. I haven't really settled the question for myself whether God is there and to be counted on. I'm toying with the idea, but it's not a settled question for me. Another similar sort of word he uses here is when he talks about double-minded. What we mean by hypocritical, I think. What we say we believe is not really what we believe. We dabble in it, we talk as if we believe it now and then, but it hasn't really taken root in our thinking. Anything comes along to push us in another direction, and now we're thinking as if it's not true. And just as Jesus said that it is the one who believes who will receive what he asks for, James here says the same thing. The man without faith, the doubting man, the double-minded man, should not expect to get anything from God. It is the person who believes that God will do what he has said he will do that in the end will receive it. Okay, so there's a few of the pieces. What does this add up to? What is his message? What is he trying to get across? What should we take away from this? It seems to me that there are two problems we need to solve here. First of all, James has just given a very encouraging message about how God generously gives wisdom to those who ask. Why has he turned around now and given this sober warning as kind of an addition to this encouraging message? What's it there for? And the second problem is, and I wrestled with this quite a bit when I was younger, it seems fairly clear to me now the way to resolve it, but in earlier days, the question occurred to me, if wisdom in this passage is a maturity of faith, as he's describing, and I think it is, then is he saying, if you lack faith, ask of God, but you have to have faith? It really does seem like kind of a catch-22. It's almost like saying, if you lack wisdom, he'll give it to you, but you better be wise. That doesn't seem to be as great a promise as it might sound at first, if I have to have the very thing that I'm asking for. Okay. But I think there's a way to understand what he's getting at here that makes a great deal of sense and really helps us to get a picture of how he sees our situation as immature believers asking for wisdom from God. James is writing to people whose behavior has been foolish, ungodly, unchristian. And as we go through the letter, we're going to see more and more why that is, the specifics of what he's getting at there. But I think there are two reasons why there might be this foolish and ungodly and unchristian behavior in the life of someone that he's writing to. One, they might not really be believers, in fact. They are hypocrites who cannot demonstrate their faith under trial because their hearts are still hardened against God. This is just like the parable that Jesus tells about the shallow soil where there's an initial interest and yet ultimately it doesn't survive. Or the soil where there's the competing plants that choke out the plant ultimately. There might be an initial interest, but in the end it's not anything that's going to last. But there's another reason why this might be, why behavior like this might be happening in someone's life. And that is, they might genuinely be believers, but be immature in their faith. Their faith is real, but they are still driven by foolish passions and fears. Through trials, they need to grow up to embrace the implications of their faith, and ultimately they will. This makes a great deal of difference. As I'm giving a word of exhortation to a group of people that seem to be conducting themselves in a foolish way, the fact is that some of the people I'm talking to may just be genuinely deceived at this point. They are believers, but they haven't thought through what it means to be a believer. And secondly, some of them might be in this foolish place because they really have no intention of submitting their lives to God ultimately. Immature believers are in this place where there is a great tension between the sort of the seed of faith, the beginnings of faith in their heart, and the foolishness of how they live. If they were to realize that James is right, and that they really have been foolish, and they have not understood how they ought to be living their life, they may lack a strong, mature faith, but they still have a real faith that he can appeal to. Now, I have to admit that partly this seems plausible and real to me because as I look at my own experience, and I hate to give myself as an example, but it's the example I know the best, this is exactly how I see my situation in the early struggles of my Christian experience. And I struggled greatly. I became a Christian at 18 from having been an atheist and a hostile unbeliever. I mean, hostile to Christianity. I saw myself as being quite above Christians. And in the early years of my faith, I struggled with all sorts of issues. I struggled with the fact that my life wasn't going the way I wanted it to go, and I blamed God for that, and, you know, why aren't you giving me what I want out of life, God? And I struggled with the gospel. What is it? How do I understand myself as a sinner? And I mean, my life as a believer in the first early years, as I think of them now, seem to me to be mostly turmoil over the questions of the gospel. And yet, I can remember this kind of stance that I think is just like what James is calling for. On the one hand, I found myself almost coming to the point of wanting to tell God to get lost. You know, why don't you just shove it? Because this is not what I was looking for. And yet at the same time, I did not do that, and I didn't do it because I genuinely believed that God was there and that I wanted the salvation that he was offering. I just didn't understand what was going on. I was very confused. And I can remember these points where I would say, there was nothing in my life that you would look at that would... you would particularly point to say, here is a mature, wise believer. And yet I would come to this point where I standing before God, I'm saying, I trust you. I have no idea what's going on with this stuff, but I trust you, and I'm asking you to help me understand who you are and what the heck you want from me. So there's this belligerent, foolish, but trusting person who is dealing with God. A foolish man with a weak faith, but a real faith. Now, when I look at that description, a foolish man with a weak faith, but a real faith, I'm tempted to think this is the same guy that's talking to you now. But the fact is, there is a difference. I mean, I was genuinely wrestling with back then with, well, what do I think of this stuff? And I don't know, this is, that kind of wrestling is not happening anymore for me. And I think that's a part of this process of the maturing of faith that James is talking about. But this is what I think is giving rise to the warning that he's giving here. Okay, you've recognized in my words that maybe you're not living in a way that's appropriate with the gospel that you say you believe. I'm saying to you on the one hand that you can approach him with confidence. He will not hold it against you. He is generous. He is willing. He is able to lift you up, to bring you to a place where you understand better who you are as a believer before God and what your life is about. That's the sort of thing he does. So reach out to him. You know, if you recognize that you lack the wisdom that the mature believer ought to have, James is saying, I'm not here to chew you out over that. I mean, that can happen. Turn to God. God is gracious. God is generous. You can expect him to do this because he has promised to do it and he is able to do it. It is right for you to ask him to help you in this way. And it is right to expect him to do it. In fact, it is essential that you believe that he will do it. There are no exceptions, ultimately. You have to decide whether you believe in this God that you are approaching or not, and what you think of him. I think of the words from Hebrews 11. He who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. First of all, I have to believe that he exists. In this world, I am tempted to see reality as the stuff in front of me. But there is a God who is bigger than the world that I can see. And I think this is very much a part of the struggles. It was very much a part of my struggles, of the immature believer, that part of what I'm wrestling with is the world is pressing at me, yelling at me, this is the real deal, this is what it's about. And I'm having to sort out for myself, but yeah, but the message of the gospel is that actually there is a God who is bigger than this world and whose opinion counts more. And I also have to believe that he is a rewarder of those who seek him, which I think is a very profound thing. I have to decide in the end where to go for life. Where am I going to go to find that reward that I am looking for? Who can I trust? Where is that that is worth pursuing? Faith calls me to recognize not just that God is there, but that he is the source of my reward. I am right to go to him because what he has to offer is what I need. He is good and generous and merciful, and what he has to offer is exactly the thing that I need. So having faith is not just believing the proposition God exists and is able to do this thing. Faith must confront more personal issues. Do I believe that God is good? Do I want the reward that he has promised, a very different reward than what the world promises? So these are the very issues we confront when we are wrestling with God as immature believers. The world I live in tells me that God is irrelevant and that there are other more practical rewards that I should seek. I have to confront this question. Is God who he says he is or not? That's why I think James is saying this at this point. Look, he's saying, implicit in his thinking. I don't know what has led to what I'm seeing happening in all the churches out there. What I'm saying is anyone who recognizes that they are far from what they ought to be in their faith and life can count on God. He is the one who raises us up. He is the one who teaches us what we need to know. We can call out to him, help me to understand. Help me to be wise in this life. Help my faith to be strong. Help me to know who you are and who I am and what my life ought to be about. I can call out to God and he answers those kinds of prayers. So on the one hand, this is encouraging news. to any of us at any point. Wherever you are, call out to God. He is the only one that's going to solve the problem. But at the same time, ultimately, I am going to have to resolve something for myself. The one who receives the forgiveness and restoration from God is the one who believes that he is there and that he is good and that he will, in fact, accomplish this restoration that you're asking him for. I can go to God with a weak faith and a foolish heart and say, I believe, help me in my unbelief. But I can't expect to go to God and say, well, you know, I don't actually like the way things are going in my life too well, so, you know, I might as well throw in a prayer that you fix it up. What could it hurt? That's not the sort of attitude ultimately that is going to receive anything from God. Because the fundamental issue that we have to address for ourselves is God there or not? Am I right to go to him or not? I have a choice. I can seek life over here or I can seek it over here. And ultimately it's not going to do me any good to give lip service to the idea that God is the source of life and then ignore him and run off and try to find it someplace else. Okay, so let me make a couple of comments to conclude here then. I think there is plenty of room for honest doubt. Let me explain what I mean by honest doubt. There are all kinds of reasons why I might be wrestling with the question of who God is and whether he's there and whether I want what he has to offer and all of that. Sometimes there are rational reasons. I'm still sorting out the arguments that I've heard. We live in a world that is capable of marshaling some what sounds like some pretty powerful arguments against Christian faith. And in the midst of that, hearing things on one side, I go off to college and I hear people saying all kinds of stuff that I never thought of before. Now I'm thinking, well, I don't know, maybe there's some problem with this that I haven't considered before. That's a natural sort of thing to happen, I think. It is a part of the process of ultimately resolving for ourselves what our lives is about. And that kind of doubt, I think, which is not ultimately rooted in hostility toward God, but just confusion, I think is a very common experience for most believers at some period in their lives. The immaturity that we've been talking about of our faith can lead to what I'm calling honest doubt. Most believers, I think, if you look at the Bible, at the lives of the people in the Bible, and you look throughout human history, the testimony of Christians throughout the ages, including people you could talk to now, most Christians go through a period where they are confused and still trying to figure out what they really believe and want. It's not that they don't believe in God or are unwilling to believe in his promises, but they're just trying to sort out what it's all about. And in the midst of that, they can look pretty double-minded. It can look as if they really are hypocritical about this thing because they're pursuing several things at the same time. But I don't think ultimately that it is double-minded, at least not in the ultimate damning sort of sense. They're on the road. Their hearts are truly open to the truths of God. But being sinners still, and being fairly immature and not understanding very well what their faith is about, the battle between faith and sin in their life looks as if it could go either way. From everything that I can see, this is a normal process. My struggles are not evidence of lack of faith. And most people who have persevered and come to some level of maturity in their faith would testify that they went through things like that in the process of getting there. So I don't think that anything Jesus says or James is saying is meant to imply that is some sort of an aberration, that shouldn't happen if you're a real believer. I don't think that's what he's getting at. But there is this sense in which faith, genuine faith, is not just an issue of the intellect, but it is an issue of the will. It is what I am willing to believe. The evidence is there, the promises are there, there is every reason why I ought to accept it. But ultimately I have to decide, I am willing to see it, even though it's kind of humiliating because it brands me as a sinner, unworthy of life before God. And it's kind of humiliating because I'm admitting that God is the power in the world, not me. As I say all the time, I mean, one of the fundamental issues I have to come to grips with as a believer is that God is the center of the universe and not me. Those are hard things to deal with, but ultimately we must. So that movement of the will, that decision, I will know God as God. I am willing to submit to the truth that He is there and that He is the one from whom life is to be found. That's a decision that all of us must make. And I think that's the tension that James is exploring here. There can be any level of folly and immaturity in my life, and the appropriate thing for me to do is to call out to God for help. I can't solve this problem, but you can solve this problem. But in calling out to God for help, even there, ultimately I'm going to have to come to terms with the fact that I'm calling on a God that I am willing to admit is there, and that I'm willing to admit is good, and is more powerful than the powers in the world around me. I'm going to Him because I think He's the one to go to. So, it seems to me there is, as I'm saying, a positive and negative aspect to what we're called to do. Positively, we are called to submit to the idea that there is a God to whom I am praying, and He is the kind of God that He presents Himself as in the Bible. He is good, He is merciful, He is generous, He has made promises. And it is right for me to hear those promises and believe that He will come through, that He will do what it is that He said. It is essential that I do that. I'm not making anything up. I'm not saying, gee, I would like to believe that I'm going to get a red Ferrari, so I just will believe that I'll get a red Ferrari, and then I will. I am responding to the God who has revealed Himself and said, I am willing to believe that you are who you say you are, and that you will do what you say you will do. So that's the positive side of it, that God is there, He is good, and will do what He has promised to do. And then there is a negative side to it as well. I have to deal with the alternatives. Whatever alternatives the world seems to offer are inferior. And in fact, that's going to be something that we're going to see as a major part of the theme that James is going to explore as we go along. God offers life to those who seek it. The great decision in our life is whether He is who He claims to be, and whether the world in fact is ultimately the broken reed that it is. Am I willing to recognize that I can't count on myself or the world around me to solve the problem of my life? God is the one to go to because He's the only one who can do it, and He is willing to do it, and He has promised to do it. So this is what I think James is confronting them with. If you're wondering whether you should get that job or that job, pray to God, but make sure that you have no doubt in your mind that He will tell you which job you should get, and then He will. But if you have any doubt that He will tell you which job that you're going to get, then He won't. That's the way I've often heard this passage taught, something along those lines. Instead, James is saying something much more fundamental, that if you look at your life and you see not mature faith growing up into a godly perspective on life, but a foolish, unbelieving way of living that you're ashamed of, what should you do? Call out to God. He is generous. He is gracious. He will restore you. He will teach you what you need to know. You can count on Him to bring you up from the folly that you have gotten yourself entangled in. But it is true, you're going to have to decide, am I willing to know that this God is there and that he has made these promises and I can count on him? Am I going to believe him, or in the end, am I going to step back and say, yeah, but you know, the world has some pretty good stuff to offer too. Maybe I ought to go that way. I'll talk about God on Sunday, and I'll deal with the world as my Savior the rest of the week. Ultimately, that's not going to do it. God will accept the most immature and foolish person. But even that immature and foolish person is going to have to come to the place where they bow before God and say, you're there. You're the one to go to. I believe that you will do what you have promised. Let me say just a word about what we're going to do next week. Up until this point, James has been fairly abstract about these ideas. We don't really know what specific kinds of trials or issues that he might be talking about. Next week, we start to see him address some of the real problems that the churches have, and so some of the specific ways that these ideas impact us in real life. And we'll start into that next week. Okay, so let's take a minute or so for any questions or comments you may have.
When you looked at the verse in Matthew after he cursed the tree, were you saying that Jesus said, for instance, an example of an impossible thing, casting a mountain into the sea?
Mm-hmm.
And he could have picked anything.
Yes.
He could bench press a ton.
Uh-huh.
Could, okay.
Right.
Okay. Is that a promise to the apostles? And is that talking about people will come to believe under their tutelage that's an impossible thing?
Well, I think it has sort of expanding levels of relevance and what it would imply. I do think that some of that passage and in the upper room discourse, where we have the strongest language about how God will do this thing if you pray to him to do it, it is interesting that he's talking to his disciples who are in fact going to be given the task of going out and doing exactly the same thing that he's doing. I mean, they will be calling on God to heal people and raise the dead and do all sorts of things. So I think that much of what Jesus has to say about believing God to do big things is aimed directly at his disciples who at this point they're not getting that. I mean, they're not in that place where they have really come to terms with what God can do and their own needs to recognize who God is and believe that he will do what he has said. So I think it's relevant in that way, because something like cursing the fig tree, something miraculous like that, those are the kinds of things that the disciples are themselves going to be doing. But ultimately, then, I think the implications of it extend out to any of us at any point where we are dealing with God concerning things that he has promised to do. If I'm asking God to do something that he has not necessarily promised to do, it is appropriate for me to have confidence that he can do it, but it is not appropriate for me to have confidence that he will do it, because I don't know. I'm asking God what I would like to have happen, but I don't know whether he's going to go for that or not. I'm like Jesus in the garden, not my will but yours be done. This is what I want, but you might want something different, and I'm willing to submit to what you want rather than what I want. That's the appropriate way to pray when I'm not sure whether in fact this is what God wants. But if I'm praying for something that I know God has promised to do, I'm praying for salvation, I'm praying here for wisdom, for the maturity of my faith and that sort of thing, it is appropriate for me to believe not only that God is able to do it, but that he will do it, because this is what he has said he will do. So in that sense, what Jesus is saying about casting the mountain into the sea is just as appropriate when it comes to me praying for wisdom, which if you think about it, me becoming wise is not all that different a sort of miracle than casting a mountain into the sea. I mean, maybe even harder. So, I mean, because we could probably, if we worked at it long enough, you know, if you've heard it, what's it called? Is the Kansai Airport in Japan? I saw this fascinating TV show about it, where, you know, they have no land area in Japan for airports. So they decided to build an airport out in the middle of the sea. And so they took a mountain, basically, and leveled it and dumped it into the ocean to make a spot where they could build an airport. And unfortunately, ever since they started building it, it's been sinking. And so they have these big hydraulic lifts to kind of lift things up higher and higher. So, yeah, it's kind of funny, I think. But they went to a mountain and said, be cast into the sea, and it was. I mean, it's a mechanical problem. We can figure out ultimately how to do things like that. But I'll bet you not any one of them could have figured out how to make me a wise person. So probably is harder. But the issue is the same. God is able. He is there. He has expressed himself willing to do this. The appropriate response for me then is to believe that he will. Now, I hope this doesn't sound trivial. This is a fundamental thing that I'm talking about. When I talk to people who are struggling with their faith or some aspect of their lives, this is that spot. I can feel the resistance there, just as I felt that resistance in myself. I mean, I'm laying on the picture of how big the problem is. I'm such a problem, my life is such a problem, you know, this is not working out. And as a person trying to encourage them, I want to give them that message that, you know, God is able to deal with this. We don't want to be simplistic. It's not name it and claim it kind of stuff. It's not, hey, snap my fingers and all my problems will go away kind of stuff. But we are dealing with the God who has promised to give us wisdom, to teach us to trust him and to bring us to maturity in our faith and ultimately to bring us to life. And it is appropriate for us to believe him and to be confident that he will do that thing. And yet I can see that lack of confidence that he's going to do that thing that is a part of that struggle. You know, I'm in the midst of the deep waters and I'm having a hard time believing that anybody can get me out of these deep waters. So it's a fundamental issue that I have to confront. I can't get myself out of these deep waters. I don't know how to get myself out of these deep waters, but I do have to confront the question, do I believe in the God who can get me out of these deep waters? And I think that's a very important issue. I mean, it's a fundamental issue. And so that's why I think James is saying this here, is, you know, call on him, but you have to believe that he is the sort who can and will do what he has said he will do. So, any other questions, comments?
Real quick on the end of what you just said, is it the God that can get me out of these deep waters or the God that can make sense of being in the deep waters?
Well, by the deep waters, I meant that the foolishness and...
Ah, okay, there we go. So I thought you meant like life circumstances.
Right? No. Okay. What I'm saying is I feel... Because at times when for myself and when I'm dealing with people, other people who are in those kinds of places, what I feel sometimes most overwhelmed by is myself, my sense that there is no way to solve the problem of me. And here I think God is saying ultimately, no, that's not true. You're not going to solve the problem of your sin in this life. You're not going to be promised circumstances that are always happy or easy to deal with. In fact, often it will be the reverse. But to come to a place where I have some stability in my faith, some place to stand, the winds can blow and I don't get knocked down, that's the kind of thing that God is saying that he will do for us. And so I can ask that with confidence. Yeah, that's good clarification. Okay, thank you.